Today we have Scott Neuberger with us. Scott and I have been friends since 2010, so it's been a little over 7 years. And he and I have known each other through the Entrepreneurs Organization. Scott is an interesting guy in that he is a triple threat. He has done a startup, he has done a turnaround, and he has done a corporate spin out called Tag that we're going to hear about today. He's also has a wife and four young kids. And a little known fact may be that he is the number one New England Patriots fan in San Diego. So with that, Scott, we're glad to have you here on the show today.
Thank you, Drew. Thank you, Brandon.
Great to have you. So, Scott, why don't you tell us a little bit more about how you acquired this company and what you learned from that?
Sure. So in 2013, with a partner, we started looking for undervalued technology companies to acquire, and we're particularly focused on businesses that were already founded or owned by larger corporations. And we were introduced to a team at Qualcomm that had started it launched a GPS tracking product for pets called Tag 2 years prior to that, which was the culmination of a significant amount of research and development by Qualcomm to develop a very small, lightweight, long-lasting, from a battery perspective, cellular GPS tracking device. It immediately became very interesting to us because it was clear that there was very, very high end technology involved, intellectual capital that was hard to come by, especially for the size business that it was. So there was a very large difference between sort of how much technology was involved compared to how big the business was. That smelled like value to us and opportunity. And so we got very interested very quickly and within a few months had negotiated a creative agreement where we acquired the business from Qualcomm without actually having to pay any cash. In fact, in a lot of ways, they paid us to acquire the business. It wasn't in a great position from a dollars and cents perspective, but there was a lot of assets available, both physical and intellectual.
Wow, that is that was a lot. I mean, there's like I've got like 10 questions that came to my mind. One of them is, in the beginning, what set you off was this idea of identifying an undervalued tech company. Can you maybe tell me a little bit about like what did you mean by that, and kind of what got you to start looking into maybe existing companies to find that kind of asset?
Yeah, so what got us there was it was sort of the sum total of my partner and I's sort of careers up to that point, which was we were both. We both had entrepreneurial roots where we started businesses from scratch. Doing that and kind of fighting that fight for as long as we did, it got impressed in our memories pretty hard that there's a big difference between starting a company, even raising your first round or two rounds of capital or many after that, and ultimately selling and generating a tremendous amount of equity value in the business. And so for me personally, I focused, I became very interested in acquiring businesses as opposed to starting businesses, because it felt like I was already sort of stepping into something that had a foundation, as opposed to having to build that foundation. And I instead could really focus my energy on building the building and not have to build the foundation and the building. And so you know, we were looking in sort of all corners for that type of opportunity. What we learned though was that inside corporations, they often don't sort of fall for the sunk cost problem that a lot of, you know, individual owners and entrepreneurs sort of get stung by, which is, they get very focused on how much they've invested, both either time or money, and thus very emotionally attached to the product or service or asset they've built, thus making it hard to sometimes, you know, get them to sell it when it's in fact probably a good time for them to sell it. Inside a big company like Qualcomm, you know, they're very rational and very focused on what their opportunity cost is beyond just the capital that they're investing, and thus it was a very rational, quick conversation, and we were able to negotiate terms that we felt were very good, and that was the major focus on why we were focusing on companies to begin with.
So did Qualcomm have that kind of listed for sale, or did you meet them in your networking and kind of through your network, or how did you like really find out about this opportunity? Because I know a lot of people want opportunities like this, and you kind of look online and you try to find companies for sale, but how did you like actually connect with them and then kind of move down those discussions?
Previously, they had retained an investment banker to market the business, but the first kind of round had kind of that process had sort of run its course, and they hadn't developed any strong possibilities, and that was right around the time that we got personally introduced to the team that was in charge there, and sort of the combination of the personal introduction and the fact that the strategic review hadn't really generated any significant potential meant that the Qualcomm decided just to deal with us directly and not through their investment banker, but that was just sort of a circumstance of, you know, product of the circumstances.
Now, Scott, some people might say that getting an asset that they had invested, I think you said maybe over $100 million for no cash down, to say that is terms that are very good, that could be maybe the understatement of the year. How did you get that? Yeah.
How did that whole process work with no cash? Like, what were the terms of that deal?
Well, so the terms of the deal involved a promissory note that my partner and I gave Qualcomm. So that was the form of the purchase price. But in exchange for that sort of promissory note, and why we say that there sort of was no cash involved in the transaction, was that the company had about $5 million worth of finished goods inventory already, you know, in its warehouse of the GPS tracking product. And so those were among the assets that we acquired, which we were able to sell, to retailers and consumers, and net more than the $3 million promissory note that we issued to Qualcomm. So in essence, that's why they quote unquote paid us to take the business.
That makes sense. Why were they looking to sell?
They were looking to sell, we believe, because they were, Qualcomm has very big visions and very big, they're trying to tackle very big problems and create very big opportunities. And when they went down the path of TAG, it was because they thought they were creating a cell phone sized opportunity. Some of their early marketing campaigns called it a cell phone for dogs. And I think that was their, desire or wish, but it turned out not to be the reality of the time. And so when it became clear that it was not going to be a cell phone sized opportunity, then it was, you know, just like I said, a sort of a question of, you know, what is their opportunity cost relative to continue doing this, and the engineers and the people that they are putting on it, and sort of the reputation that they're investing in it. What else could that be doing for them?
Absolutely. So you kind of got the brand and you got some of their inventory. Did you also get any of their staff?
We tried. About 10 people from Qualcomm ended up joining the company as an independent entity. We tried to get more, and it's hard to get people to get out of a large corporation like Qualcomm. So we had to supplement the team quite significantly. I mean, you know, part of the turnaround effort involved reducing the expenses of the business substantially, and so we had to learn to live on less. But you know, the business at Qualcomm had north of 50 employees and a lot of support from other sort of pieces of the Qualcomm infrastructure. And we had, you know, we built a team of about 20 to start with, and it ultimately got up to about 30.
How did that transition work? Like, you know, day one, you had the deal, you walk into the office on Monday morning. How did it go from there?
Yeah, so, you know, the way it felt like was, you know, jumping on a moving train and trying to change direction. From almost a total stop. I mean, everything had to be done over, like in terms of even just, you know, finding an office and, you know, setting up payroll and, you know, computers and desks and everything like that, all the way to, you know, recasting the marketing strategy, getting work started on a next generation product as soon as possible. Which we started, you know, pretty much right when we acquired the business in mid 2013, and then that product started shipping to customers in early 2015. It was a complex product that took a long time to build. We knew that if it was going to be a long term success, we needed to continue to innovate on the product itself, and that was a long term investment. So. I mean, there's just so many things to do in such a short period of time. And, you know, by nature of the fact that it was also a business that was, you know, I think safe to say in a distressed situation, there was, you know, always a focus on, you know, are we improving the business or just, you know, sort of pushing the can down the road?
Scott, when you bought it, I guess who was with you in that purchase, and then like kind of what was the game plan or thinking of like, hey, this is where we're going to take this?
Yeah, so my partner on the transaction was Jim Braylene, so the two of us were the ones doing the transaction. We formed the board of the company. And we invested nearly all the capital that went into the company after the transaction. In terms of how we decided what to do, you know, I wish we could say we had this grand master plan, you know, that was fully baked out on day one. It wasn't exactly as clean as that. You know, what we first, you know, did the first 6 months were purely focused on just, you know, proving that, you know, there was a pulse and that we could control that pulse in the business in terms of being able to, you know, invest marketing dollars and increase sales or, invest in the customer experience and decrease churn or, you know, reduce costs and still have, you know, everything working. in the business. And during that process, we were also just sort of thinking a lot about the company and where we wanted to take it, and went through a lot of different ideas. I mean, for a long time, in fact, pretty late into the owner to the period where we owned the business, we had considered using it more as a platform to launch other Internet of Things consumer products, consumer or business to business products that could operate on the same technological infrastructure that was built for the GPS, the pet GPS device. Over time, we ended up focusing only on the pet space, and that was mostly because it was the biggest market opportunity. It was the most defined market opportunity in front of us, and I think it was a good decision in the end.
So, you launched this. You said, we didn't have this grandmaster plan, and you're going after things. I guess what were some of the things that worked that you kind of like, wow, this really worked well? And maybe what were some of the biggest challenges that you had that you ran into?
Sure. So, I think on the biggest challenges side, I think, we could, taking the product out of Qualcomm was one thing, but removing all of but really reforming the cost structure of the business, which was really driven by, which was dictated by a lot of, decisions that Qualcomm had made about, how the product was manufactured, where it was manufactured, and how the service was the infrastructure for the service was created and maintained, largely using, very expensive enterprise level software, which was appropriate for a company like Qualcomm building another cell phone, but not necessarily the same decisions that, a startup focusing on, consumer technology device would have made. It was harder than we anticipated to sort of turn the ship around and reduce the cost of the business, which necessitated more investment in the company. On the positive side, or on the accomplishments that, I look back fondly on, I would say that we really dramatically changed the customer lifetime value and by lengthening the average customer lifespan, or the amount of time that a customer was a subscriber to the service after buying the product. There was, no one silver bullet there, but it was a lot of just really focused time talking to customers, understanding their experience, understanding what was the good and the bad of that experience, and really focusing on fixing that, improving that experience, getting them connected to the product early on in their ownership period, and also, coming up with a better, warmer brand so that we were attracting people more because they'll love their pet more than the sort of more colder, just pure technological specs of the product.
What did your team look like at this point? Like, who did you have on the team and kind of in what seats and what positions?
So most of the team was focused on engineering, either hardware or software. The balance of it was I would say 60% of the team was probably software, because there was a pretty robust infrastructure that was built by Qualcomm that had to be maintained, and not only maintained but also redesigned basically from scratch, as quickly as possible. So that was a big undertaking and necessitated most of the team effort. The next biggest team was really our marketing team. We had a CMO and several people that worked for him. And so it really was a software dominated team, and you know, and one that, you know, also had to market and grow the net subscriber base as fast as possible.
So, I mean, in essence, you have this GPS tracking dog collar that you're selling, and you know, it's out there, it's on the market. I mean, did you have any competitors? Like, what was the space like at that point?
Yeah, so there are a handful of products out there that were ranged the gamut from a various technologies that allowed you to you know, try to locate your dog. Some of them were purpose-built for pets, but most of those did not involve pure cell phone GPS kind of connections, meaning the accuracy was much more limited, or the range was much more limited. And there were certainly other cellular GPS devices in the market that were more general tracking devices that had identified the pet market as a clear opportunity, and directed some marketing resources towards it. But there are very few pure play pet focused cellular GPS devices on the market at the time. Throughout the about 18 months that we owned the business, you know, fully, a number of products were announced. A few of them actually came to market. It was one of these areas where it's really easy to dream about the opportunity. You know, everybody knows the sort of sexiness of the pet space and the, you know, market dynamics that drive it, sort of the humanization of the pet, which is the sort of global trend that's been driving, you know, really tremendous sales growth in that space for really decades now. But actually bringing a product to market and getting it, you know, built and certified with, you know, a cellular network like Verizon, was a bunch harder to do and quite capital intensive. There were people, but there weren't really any pure play direct competitors that had, anywhere close to the size of a subscriber base that we did.
So you're off to the races. You've got, you know, farmers who are super happy because their dog that wanders away miles away, you can track them far distance. And, you know, the New York person is, you know, watching their dog get walked by their professional dog walker, and they're all paying you, or Verizon or whoever the fees to use this. Kind of, you look at the horizon and what were some of the things that, you know, you were kind of thinking of, like, you know, going next, and what were some of the options, and then ultimately, you know, what did you guys decide?
So, you know, after we sort of proved out that there was a pulse there, and that we could, the initial turnaround had taken effect, which, you know, really lowered the burn of the business from, you know, probably over $1 million a month to near cash flow neutral. So we felt like the business was self-sustaining to some extent. Then we started figuring out what we wanted to do and where we wanted to take the business. And like I said, we did, even though we kept experimenting with sort of other platform plays, using the infrastructure in other markets, most of our energy focused on pet space, and when we and the deeper we got in the pet space, you know, the more we realized that we needed a more complete team that could that could you know, fully realize the vision of TAG, and also a warmer brand. Despite our best efforts for TAG to really warm up the brand and create a story that resonated with people, the history of the company being, you know, a part of a large, you know, corporation, and it's you know, it was hard to fully put to rest and pivot away from. And so where we ultimately ended up was merging the company with a startup less than 2 years old called Whistle, that was founded to bring technology to the pet parent relationship, and had at the time launched a activity monitor, which was essentially a Fitbit for dogs, but was very interested in bringing GPS functionality to their product that they were selling to customers.
So how did that happen? I mean, did you approach them? Did they approach you? Maybe how did the connection? Talk to me about that.
So interestingly, they actually launched their business publicly the same week that we acquired the business from Qualcomm.
Oh, wow.
And so from the very beginning, we were very aware of each other. We weren't in a direct competitive space. But we were certainly the two, I think the best funded companies in sort of the pet technology space at the time. And even though we weren't direct competitors, we were quite knowledgeable of each other. And so we had formed a relationship with them early on. A friendly partnership early on. And had tracked each other's progress over that about 18-month period before the companies ultimately merged together, between when they publicly launched their product and when we acquired TAG to when the two businesses merged together, and then a few months before when the transaction actually took place. I believe they approached us specifically, and we welcomed that approach, and then we engaged in very helpful negotiations, I think, for both parties.
Hmm. So on your end, tell me did you bring someone in to help you with the process? Did you guys do all the negotiating yourself? Maybe talk to me about that. The transaction and how you negotiated that.
Yeah. I think both parties had their advisors, but it was mostly, myself and my partner and, the two co-founders or two of the three co-founders of Whistle that were the CEO and COO, just spending a lot of time talking in person on the phone, over probably 5 or 10 different meetings, and then a host of phone calls, forming a relationship. I mean, a merger, at its core depends upon, there being a strong relationship between the people that are going to be running the combined business, and so that's what we focused on, and then that ultimately, it made sense for a transaction to come out of that, both parties felt that way, and then it was just down to figuring out the terms of the transaction.
What did the terms end up being, and how long did this kind of process take from start to finish?
So I'd say it was about 3 months, 3 to 4 months, start to finish, from first contact to closing. I mean, from first, you know, contact related to this topic to closing. And the final deal terms involved a cash payment to my partner and I of about $6 million, and then a continuing equity stake in the combined business that was equal to about 20% of the combined business.
How did the you know, everybody has a horror story about business partners. How did you guys kind of merge everybody together and keep everybody on track?
Yeah, so you know, both businesses were on a very fast-paced kind of schedule, you know, focused on growth, focused on launching new products, getting them to market, growing the subscriber base. You know, one of the things I give Whistle a ton of credit for is that they had, from very early on, focused on the culture of the company, and that bled really through the business, through the whole, you know, through the office and all the different people in different places that worked for the company. And so they did a really great job of welcoming in the tag team, into that, culture. And that I think facilitated a very quick, sort of meshing of the teams. I remember there was within a month of the closing, we did an all hands, couple day retreat, where, you know, everybody, which involved, you know, probably 60 or 70 people from, you know, many states. Most people were in San Diego and San Francisco, but there were people from Hawaii, there was people from North Carolina, there was people from Colorado, lots of other places like that, that where we had, you know, one or two full-time employees that were worked out of their home. You know, they were able to really, you know, extend that culture to the tag team quite quickly. And even though the product maintained the tag name for a long time, just because of certain realities that made that hard to change on a dime, the product, the brand Whistle very much became the effective name of the business. And that I think was an important step to realizing the true value of the company, you know, beyond any, you know, in particular in one device or you know, one business model. You know, it was about building a vision for what the long-term pet and pet parent relationship would look like and how technology would really be a core piece of that.
That's great. What was the biggest thing you learned from that deal?
You know, getting to the sort of the nuts and bolts of the acquisition and the discussion, one thing I personally learned was that I think I focused too much on the method of the payment, meaning like what the total, like, you know, final percentage of the ownership stake of the business was going to be of the you know, the tag shareholders in the combined company, and less on the total dollar value of that, what the total dollar value of the deal was. And and so personally, I think I learned really you know, focusing on the dollar value first, and then sort of how that dollar value is paid, you know, whether that's equity or debt or cash or you know, other things that would be perhaps a more fruitful end to the negotiation, but nonetheless, it was a good deal.
Good. Yeah. And I mean, it sounds like the cash kind of covered the money that you'd already put in. So you know, being made whole. And so you had that, and then you had another upside with Whistle. What, you know, what was your role at, you know, when the companies came together?
I was the CFO of the combined company from the point that the companies merged to the point that that company was acquired by another party, and then a few months after that.
So, I mean, this is kind of an ideal situation in that you're getting a multiple exit scenario here. You know, to talk to us about this second acquisition. You know, how did that come about?
So, in the merger, also at the same time, Whistle raised a round of financing, simultaneously with the closing of that merger or acquisition. And one of the largest investor, actually the largest investor in that second round of financing for Whistle was Mars Petcare, which is one of the largest pet food and pet care businesses in the world. And they ended up acquiring the remaining portion of the equity. They owned, far less than a controlling stake at the point of the merger. But they ended up acquiring the rest of the equity, of the business, almost exactly a year after the transaction, the merger transaction. You know, the way it came about was really just, furthering this, they had a deeply held belief that technology was, going to be a driving relationship of the pet and pet parent relationship in the future. That's what brought them to the investment to begin with. And then the period of, you know, for the first 6 to 9 months, I guess, of the merged company, I think just cemented that in their minds and showed that, you know, what they could do as if it was a wholly owned piece of this large corporation. In some ways, it's kind of interesting that it started as a large corporation and then sort of reformed itself matured a bit and then ended up back in owned by a large corporation at the end. And I think all three of those sort of phases of its life were necessary, frankly. But it was, you'd have to talk to them to know for sure, but I would imagine it was always on the table of ideas that they were planning on. And it was just sort of a matter of timing, and the timing worked out quite perfectly for, Tag and Whistle, that they decided to move forward aggressively as quickly as they did.
I think when you hear about people raising money, they don't often think of a strategic investor like Mars. How is there any insight to how those big companies work and how you can reach out to them to raise money?
Today's world, we're all connected at some level to everybody. and I think one of the things that the CEO and COO of Whistle did so successfully is they really were able to connect with so many people and connect so effectively to so many people in lots of different areas. I don't know exactly where the Mars relationship germinated from, but I've seen this in several parts of my career that involving, strategic investors and strategic partners in a meaningful way can pay huge dividends. So I certainly recommend as much as possible to, always be focused on finding those types of investors or those types of partners, because there's more. It's the reason they call it strategic. There's more to be gained than just the dollars and cents of the transaction, and that you know, that can often lead to good things for everybody, either in sort of increased motivation, or increased valuation in dollars.
So Mars is involved. They've invested. You know, they're seeing what's happening in the combined company. You know, so it seems like they've got the inside track. Were they the only kind of person or party at the table?
There were other bidders when it came down to it, and that's you know when I referenced sort of great timing, it worked out that that there were some competitor bidders that were let's say important competitors for Mars that I think spurred them to move faster than they otherwise might have, and that was good for everybody involved.
Bidding wars are always good when you're in the sales process, right? So where did it end up? You know, what did you sell for? You know, what were some of the terms of the sale?
The business sold for $100 million cash, on top of that, and sort of there were several other sort of subterms to it, but they were all sort of around the concept of trying to maintain the independence of Whistle inside of Mars, and I'll give them the freedom to continue to flourish, but with less focus or less worrying about the short-term cash implications of their growth plans, and really focus on building the best and most valuable long-term brand and set of services that they could. And so we're just over a year since that transaction, I guess about almost 15 months from since that transaction, and even though I have not been involved for just about a year now, everything I see and hear is that it's going swimmingly well.
Awesome. And I'm no mathematician, but 20% of 100 mil sounds like 20 mil. So is that what you and your partners got?
I can neither confirm. No, I'm kidding. Yes, 20% of $100 million is $20 million.
That's fantastic. So you'd already received six, and so you get another 20. I guess what were your emotions when how are you feeling when you heard that deal closed, and what was going on in your mind and at that moment?
It was a great feeling. I guess obviously. It felt very validating for the amount of risk that we took in the transaction, and the different decisions we made that ultimately seemed to turn out about as good as we could do, but certainly wasn't always looking like that was the case or that's what was the outcome was going to be. So I just think it felt great, and it felt validating, and it really, spurred me and motivated me to get working on the next deal and see if we can get any even bigger than that.
In that moment, I guess, where were you when you heard the deal closed, and what's the first thing you did?
I was sitting at my desk in the office, and I heard that it had closed. I was not in the deal room when it happened. But it had been expected that day, and essentially, I think in today's world, as we all know, it's often sort of remote signatures and it's less dramatic or climactic than it may have been in the past. But what did I do? I mean, I think I emailed a lot of my friends and family and telling them about the news and sitting back and saying, wow, I can't believe that really just happened.
You logged into your bank account to make sure it was all there.
That's so exciting. What? How else did your life change after that?
Well, I think more than anything, it broadened my view of the horizon of what's really possible. And it focused me on thinking bigger. And so that's it also afforded me basically for about the last year, been able to I've probably worked just about as hard as I've ever worked, but under a very different environment without a company to run or investors to report to, and been able to chart my own course and explore lots of different things, make several investments, and and I think plant a lot of seeds for what should be very fruitful harvests in the future.
Yeah, everybody says think bigger. People have told me that forever. Like, what does that really mean for you now compared to how you were thinking before? And then kind of how will it change how you think in the future?
I think one way it manifests for me is that, to not worry as much about how I would finance deal X, Y, or Z, or what the size of the targets that I'm going after. That there's different financing opportunities and different sources of funding for all sizes of transactions, and that just because it's a larger business or a larger size transaction doesn't mean it's a harder transaction, or that it is that you need something that I don't already have. I think it's just focusing more on the specifics of the opportunity and less on the dollar numbers involved. Having confidence that if the opportunity is right, the funding and the financing for the transaction will be there.
Absolutely. Awesome. What's one piece of advice you'd give to someone who wants to sell their company?
Try to get multiple bidders involved.
Nice. One question I have, which goes back a little bit, but when I sold the last company, I went out and got a golf cart that's big pimpin'. It's got hydraulics. It's all black and surround sound, etc. Was there something that you went out and bought and splurged on, after the transaction closed?
No, not any one thing, but I would say that, the year plus less pressure finding opportunity, focusing on finding opportunities or just exploring things, and at a disciplined but slow pace was the biggest thing I splurged on. I didn't feel like I had any defined demand to earn a salary or to make a certain amount of money in this past year. And I think that I'm very, very thankful for that, and certainly the transaction afforded me that ability.
Absolutely. What do you think you'll work on next now?
Well, so I actually have two just sort of operating things happening right now. One is my same partnership with Jim Berline. We're continuing to look for the next sort of undervalued technology company, and and potentially, you know, do another transaction along the same lines of TAG. And then at the same time, I've also formed a new group called Crown Growth. You know, we're focused on finding great entrepreneurs and great businesses and linking them to strong private equity firms and affecting a roll-up transaction where platforms acquire add-on companies and are able to deliver great returns for themselves and their shareholders.
That's exciting. How can our listeners stay in touch with you through your journey?
So you can reach me at scott@crowngrowth.com or on LinkedIn. You can find me, Scott Neuberger, and certainly love to talk to anybody.
Awesome, Scott. What a great story. You know, a lot of pieces here for people to learn from. Congratulations on all your success, and we look forward to continuing to hear what you're up to.
Great. Thank you.